Republican David Jolly was elected to Florida's 13th congressional district during a special election in March 2014 following the death of longtime incumbent Bill Young. Jolly was re-elected that November and is now running for U.S. Senate. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at BayCareEvents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WSF Public Media, I'm Carson Cooper, and I'd like to welcome to our studios for this Florida Matters Newsmaker Special, Congressman David Jolly.
Well, thank you, Carson. It's good to be back.
So you're seeking the Senate seat being vacated by Marco Rubio. Is he your man?
Actually, I have already offered my support to Jeb Bush, but I say I'm excited about having a president from the state of Florida, and I actually think there's four or five candidates who call Florida home, but I'm really talking about Jeb and Marco when I say that.
Let me ask you about them. Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, most pundits think that they've been running fairly good campaigns,
sure,
saying all the right things, doing well in the debates. Why are they failing to gain traction in the polls?
I think it's a long race. And, you know, this is the time where people are kind of feeling out a very diverse field of 16 or 17 candidates. It might go up, might go down. You know, but think 4 years ago, you had the likes of Herman Cain at one point who was leading, Michelle Bachmann at one point who was leading, Rick Santorum. So I don't know how to explain that phenomena. But what I do know is throughout 10 or 11 months of a very long race, ultimately we end up with candidates who demonstrate the greatest qualifications. And so I think you will see both Jeb and Marco there at the very end.
So it's no secret that Marco Rubio does not like the Senate. During the second debate, he defended his dismal voting record by saying that, hey, when it's a vote that's meaningful, I'll be there.
Right.
And as far back as 2 years ago, Rubio had complained that nothing gets done in the Senate.
Sure.
So does that worry you?
It does worry me. But first, let's talk about votes. I prided myself on never missing a vote. Listen, I believe members of Congress are elected to hold the public trust. And that means showing up for work, and that means taking votes. So I had a record of 700 or 800 votes straight before one Monday night, Rich Nugent from North County and myself ended up on a plane that got diverted because of weather. We couldn't land in Washington. We missed a few votes. One of the things I'm not going to let happen in this Senate race is to stop doing my day job. I got elected to be a member of the House, not to run for higher office. And so my first priority is to do the job of being a member of Congress. Now, does it worry me that Congress is doing nothing? Yes. Here's the problem. It's not the do-nothing Congress. It's the try-nothing Congress. And what do I mean by that? What's the greatest issue we face in the presidential debate right now? It's border security and immigration reform. Well, where is the Congress in this debate? I've asked leadership, open up the floor for the next 3 weeks and let's have the debate on border security and immigration. Where are we on a multi-year transportation bill? Where are we on our constitutional responsibility to debate whether or not we are a nation in conflict with ISIS, what's called an authorization to use military force? We have simply acquiesced to the president's decision, but we have a constitutional responsibility to engage. Where are we on a budget that actually balances, that actually gets something done? My greatest frustration since serving, and I think this was reflected in Marco's comments, is what we're not considering in Congress. It's not the result. It's that we're not even bringing up the legislation.
I think voters see, you know, they see the House and the Senate, both controlled by the Republicans.
Well, that's right.
They have, voters are fed up. They see failures to dismantle Obamacare, nothing on immigration, the Iran nuclear accord, deficit reduction, Planned Parenthood, and they see the party as its own worst enemy.
That's right. And that is why you're seeing questions about our current leadership. You know, the truth is we read it in the papers every day. We hear about it on the radio. There are concerns about the state of our current leadership in Congress based on that, right? So imagine this, and we promised the American people after the last election day that we would move measures through the House and Senate, put it on the president's desk, and ask him to own his own legacy, sign it, veto it, negotiate with us. But the fact is, we're not even getting stuff to the president's desk. That's a failure of the Congress. Now, I will say the Senate has a rule of 60. The Republicans in the Senate do not have a majority of 60. And so Harry Reid has been very effective at grinding things to a halt. It's still not good enough. And I actually think rather than throw in the towel, what we need to do is I've suggested go on to session Monday mornings at 9 o'clock, leave Fridays at 6 o'clock, require members to be on the floor working together. Let's at least give voice to the American people. You mentioned border security and immigration. I don't know how that debate turns out, but I know as a nation we will appreciate seeing a Congress that works and perhaps have the ability to then work with the White House.
On the Iranian nuclear accord, a number of Republicans had been urging Senate Majority Leader McConnell to change Senate rules to prevent a filibuster on a resolution to kill the deal, the nuclear option.
Right.
Were you in favor of that rule change?
I would be in favor of that rule change for the Iran deal, yes. I strongly disagree with the Iran deal. I believe we should not have been negotiating in the first place. I believe it creates a pathway to a nuclear-armed Iran and economically enriches a regime that wishes to destroy us. There are moments where we cannot let procedural rules dictate matters of such historical significance. That is true of the Iran deal.
Now, that nuclear option was the same option Harry Reid exercised about 2 years ago for some Obama court appointees.
For judicial appointments.
Which Republicans railed against. So would that be hypocritical if Republicans did the same thing 2 years later?
So, you know, the Supreme Court test, you know it when you see it. I think when matters are of such historic significance that the Senate should perhaps repeal the vote of 60 rule for that purpose. So take the Iran deal, yes. Judicial appointments, I don't know that that rises to the level of historical significance, but I know the Iran deal does. This is one of the most consequential national security votes the Congress will take. It has been of great concern to the American people. It forever changes our foreign policy in the Middle East with a nation state that has said they wish to destroy the United States. I don't believe a procedural rule in the Senate is sufficient to quiet the voice of the American people. I would hope that Senator McConnell would choose the nuclear option on the rule of 60 and allow a straight up or down vote. And listen, the result would be to put something on the president's desk and ask him to own his legacy. The rule of 60 was invoked to protect the president's legacy. That it was merely a political decision by the Democrats.
You think the Senate should just eliminate the filibuster altogether?
You know, I don't serve in the Senate, and I understand that the filibuster has very significant historical significance and precedence for the body. So as a sitting House member, am I prepared to suggest we repeal the filibuster? No. I think there are rules that you have in place that require and insist on deliberation. I think what's changed in modern politics is you can look at the advent of the modern television age from the 1970s on and then the information age. Consider that we used to elect candidates who would go to Washington, legislate, work with people on both sides of the aisle, come home, and report back on what they had done. We only had a couple nightly news shows an evening, and they would rarely cover Washington. Today, because of the power of media and all the new mediums, we elect candidates not based on their ability to legislate, but on their ability to own the media market. We have a different personality in the Senate and the House right now. The filibuster, I believe, used to be respected for what it was, which was an appropriate institutional tool. I think now it's taken advantage of because we have a very different makeup of Congress.
This summer, you announced your support for same-sex marriage as a policy, saying it's appropriate for states to recognize same-sex marriages and traditional marriages. You went on to say that you also believe in the biblical definition of marriage of one man and one woman. So the critics just pounced all over
sure,
you.
Sure, sure.
John Stenberger, who backed the 2008 ban on gay marriage in Florida, called you a coward and betraying the very people who put you into office.
Right. So a couple things, Carson. I actually articulated this very same message during the special election. I did so on Political Connections on a Sunday morning, and I remember going into the parking lot and calling my mother. So I'm a preacher's kid. My father's a retired Southern Baptist minister. That makes my mother a preacher's wife, and they still serve a community in Pasco County. And I remember that day during the special election calling my parents to say, hey, the news story this week is going to be that I support same-sex marriage on same par as traditional marriage. I've done so since law school when I realized constitutionally in the late 90s that I don't look to the state for the sanctity of marriage. I look to my own faith and my own God. And I think the Constitution affords everybody that same right. Why it wasn't picked up on in the special, I'll never know. But when I affirmed last summer what I had said several times before, it did catch the political storm. I understand for many people this is a hard issue. I respect that. I also understand for many people, like John, it's not a hard issue. They are very resolute in their belief. I'm somebody who, as a matter of my Christian faith, believes in traditional marriage. But as a less government conservative that believes in individual liberty for everybody across the country, I believe it's appropriate and it should be required that states recognize both same-sex marriage and traditional marriage. Marriage, as I see it, is defined by my God and my faith, and everybody should be afforded the same liberty to do the same.
If it's the law and it's approved by the court, you're okay with that as a law, as a policy?
I think it should be the law that states recognize both same-sex and traditional marriage. You get in a question of jurisdiction. I don't believe the federal government has jurisdiction over the process of recognizing marriages in terms of the legal process within a state, right? I believe in the 10th Amendment. There's nothing in the Constitution about marriage. That's absolutely true. I think it's a matter reserved for the state. But in defining the liberty of an individual to pursue recognition of their relationship, I do believe that is a constitutional protection provided them at the federal level. And so as a state manages the process of recognizing and granting marriage licenses, I believe that a state should be required to recognize both traditional marriage and same-sex marriage.
Now, if same-sex marriage is against your religious convictions, there are other divisive issues like abortion. You wouldn't say you're against abortion personally, yet be okay with federal funding for it, would you?
No, that's a great question, and here's the distinction. No, I oppose federal funding of abortion, and frankly, I think we need to do everything we can to create a culture that values life and reduces the number of abortions. And here's the distinction. I believe that life begins at conception. Okay, others might agree with me. Some might believe life begins at the first trimester, second trimester, or at birth. Here's what I know. The point at which you believe life begins, we are all pro-life. Everybody believes in protecting human life. The question is, at what point do you believe life begins? But understand, wherever you stand on where life begins, it becomes non-negotiable in terms of protecting that human life. So I see it as a very different issue than the test of religious liberty that we apply to marriage, because this now involves the protection of life, which is a constitutional protection as well. I believe life begins at conception, so I'm going to do everything I can to protect that life. Now, within the construct of the current law and the constitutional interpretation of the court, I believe the best thing we can do is move in the direction of a culture that values life. We should not be using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions. There is currently a law against that. I also believe we need to examine if Roe v. Wade set a viability test. That was 40 years ago. Science is very different. The question of viability is probably very different than when the Roe v. Wade court made its decision and relied on viability as the standard upon which they determined a third trimester abortion should be illegal.
Now, you voted in favor of a bill to yank federal funding for Planned Parenthood.
I did.
The federal fiscal year ends on the 30th. Is defunding Planned Parenthood worth a government shutdown, as some have warned?
Nothing short of the security of the United States of America is worth shutting down the federal government. Listen, I say I'm a governing conservative, not a shutdown conservative. And that's a very real distinction, both in this United States Senate race, but also in members of Congress who currently serve. We have a responsibility as a Congress to govern and to keep the government open. Frankly, I would suggest members of Congress shouldn't be paid if the government shuts down, and there should be even greater penalties than that. Let's talk about the Planned Parenthood issue briefly, because it is important. Planned Parenthood operates on a budget of about $1.3 billion. There's about $500 million in federal funding that goes to Planned Parenthood. So Planned Parenthood would not disappear simply because we revoked taxpayer dollars pending an investigation of the allegations of leadership at Planned Parenthood. But here's the other thing that's very important. Throughout the state of Florida, there are approximately, I believe, 23 to 25 Planned Parenthood facilities. There are over 600 federally supported community health clinics capable of providing the same services to communities throughout Florida. So we are also talking about a vendor who actually operates in a very small space compared to how we provide health care to underserved communities. I also want to make a point about how I approach some of these very hard issues. The Planned Parenthood videos were shocking. The allegations, and much of it on tape, is that they manipulated the performance of abortions for the specific purposes of harvesting fetal tissue for commerce. That, if true, and it is on tape, so it is appropriate that we have a very strong investigation. That, if true, not only breaks the law, but I think breaks the spirit of the American people to recognize there's an organization doing that that's receiving taxpayer dollars. You immediately had a House bill filed to revoke funding for Planned Parenthood. It received about 150 co-sponsors. I did not co-sponsor it, and here's why. I actually read bills before I vote on them. I read bills before I sponsor them. And I recognize that that bill risked cutting $500 million in funding for critical non-abortion women's health care services in underserved communities across the country. And I did not want to see the top-line funding for these medical services be reduced. So I actually introduced my own legislation regarding Planned Parenthood. And the first several paragraphs say we are going to maintain funding, full funding, for women's health care services in underserved communities. No abortion services may be provided by taxpayer dollars, but we are going to continue to fully fund women's health care services. We are, however, going to disqualify Planned Parenthood as being a recipient of that funding, pending a full investigation. I think that's the appropriate way to approach what is a very difficult issue.
This is a Florida Matters Newsmaker Special with District 13 Congressman and candidate for U.S. Senate, Republican David Jolly. We have extended invitations to the other candidates, so stay tuned on that. Coming up,
they took what was one of the fairest districts in the country at the time, a district Obama won twice, but elected a Republican member of Congress, and they created what is likely just one more supermajority district that will contribute to the gridlock and dysfunction in Washington.
More on the issues with Congressman David Jolly. I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. This is Florida Matters. I'm speaking with Congressman David Jolly, and you're in favor of easing travel restrictions for Americans in Cuba. Is that to say that you're on board with the president's effort to normalize relations with Cuba?
I'm not on board with the president's current strategy, no. I think the president's current strategy is too much too quickly, too soon. What I have said about travel is this. The ultimate test of any easing of restrictions on the Castro regime is, does he use the economic enrichment that comes with greater economic ties to empower his regime, which crushes liberty for political dissidents? Or does he use it to actually grow the economy of the people and improve the infrastructure that is continuing to fail in Cuba? We have a growing travel relationship with the people of Cuba. It is private travel, person to person. I think it's appropriate we maintain that, we allow that to grow, we see culturally what develops from it, and we also are able to test the Castro regime to say, if you are going to be enriched from increased travel, how are you going to use those funds? Because understand, the president has said, look, we will take away the embargo, we'll normalize relations, and we're still facing a regime that says they're going to use their economic power against their own people, demand that the U.S. apologize, pay reparations, give back our naval station on Guantanamo Bay. I believe the president has moved too quickly. What I have said is let's take a much more measured approach, allow travel to foster, and then let's make decisions from there.
Now, many anti-Castro activists like Tampa attorney Ralph Fernandez says loosening the travel ban, however fast or slow that happens, would simply pump more money into Cuba, helping the Castros, but would not bring about any change in Cuba.
Well, let us see. And if that is the case, then we never move to lifting the embargo. So understand that how votes have occurred over the course of the summer in the House. There have been many votes that would have eased restrictions on Cuba, eased the embargo, allowed for contracts with the Cuban government. I have voted with those, particularly in the South Florida delegation, who oppose any loosening. I have voted to keep the embargo in place to continue the restrictions. The one area where I have broken with my party is on the notion of travel. For the reasons I suggested about it, it gives us an opportunity to test and verify Castro's intentions. But we do also know that the Tampa area could likely be the epicenter of renewed relations should that day come. We are seeing it through travel right now. Should we see a day where the people of Cuba are free and we can have more open relations, I hope Tampa will benefit from that.
Congressman David Jolly is running for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Marco Rubio. And here's a question from a listener. Dolo DeLong wants to know, how will you address the refugee situation for Syrians fleeing their war-torn country? And she adds, don't address the war. The question is about the people.
Sure. We are a loving and caring nation with a history of accepting refugees and those with legitimate humanitarian claims. I don't believe that this situation should be any different than our history of bringing in people from the Balkans and resettling them. Those who came from Somalia in the last two decades and were resettled. We accept tens of thousands of refugees and those with humanitarian claims every year. I believe we need to be accommodating to a responsible number of Syrians that we believe we can responsibly accept and assimilate into our current economy. The question is always security, and that is a rightful concern that's been raised by many. It's a concern I share. We cannot do this blindly. We need to do so under the protocols that were set up after 9/11 to provide additional screening. The issue is not whether or not we remain a loving and caring nation. We should, and we should accept refugees. The issue is insisting that we have appropriate security protocols in place. That will be the only lens through which I analyze this issue.
All right, Congressman Jolly, indulge me, if you will, sure, in a little politics here. Jeff Miller decided not to run for the nomination for Rubio's seat. Lieutenant Governor Lopez Cantera is running. Ron DeSantis. Am I missing anyone here? I think those are your other two main competitors for the
GOP. They are, nomination. And then there's a businessman, defense contractor from Orlando.
So you've got you in the Bay Area, Lieutenant Governor in South Florida, DeSantis in the Jacksonville area. No one really has statewide recognition at this point, except maybe the Lieutenant Governor. What is your game plan for owning the primary?
Well, I'm pleased that every poll that has been taken by third parties has us in the lead. I believe it's an affirmation of the fact that as a conservative Republican, we are trying to govern responsibly for a very diverse community like Pinellas. So I believe it's been our decision to get in the race has been affirmed. I will tell you, geographically, I get excited about having a United States senator from the Tampa Bay area. We've never had a senator from Pinellas County. 1 in 3 Republican primary voters are from the Tampa Bay area. What I like about that statistic is the following. I ran for the House of Representatives to serve in the House of Representatives. I get up every morning excited about the opportunity I have to serve in the House. I didn't run for the House to run for higher office. Along the way, the state Supreme Court invalidated our congressional district. They took what was one of the fairest districts in the country at the time, a district Obama won twice but elected a Republican member of Congress, and they created what is likely just one more supermajority district that will contribute to the gridlock and dysfunction in Washington. I believe in this Senate race, if we just keep doing our job in the Bay Area that we were elected to do, that in itself will be enough to carry us to the nomination.
Now, you mentioned the redistricting. You won District 13 by a pretty slim margin. Many observers say a new map will almost guarantee a Democrat is in that seat next. Did that factor into your decision to run for U.S. Senate?
So I would say in the special election, we won with 48% of the vote, right? And I immediately went to work demonstrating, one, that we could deliver results, and two, that I could give voice to all parties. And so about 6 months later, we were elected with 75% of the vote. Now, understand the Democrats failed to field a very strong candidate, but I believe that also is a reflection of the fact that we have shown we are willing to work with everybody in every political party on what's right for our community. So I actually believe even if the Supreme Court maps were to increase the Democratic numbers by several percentage points, I still believe we would win re-election because I believe we've served with a spirit that people appreciate. Here's the problem with decisions like we just saw from the Supreme Court. I was actually working on a law journal article for the Harvard Journal of Legislation about redistricting. If you go back a year ago, I said on Larry King, the problem with the United States Congress today is we have 350 to 375 districts that are supermajority one party or another. meaning every day they wake up thinking about their party before their community, meaning if they ever compromise with the other side of the aisle, they'll lose in a primary to somebody on their right if they're a Republican or on their left if they're a Democrat. There are only 30 to 40 seats in the Congress that are true swing seats, and probably only 15, when you get down to it, that are truly toss-ups. This is one of them. If we created districts across the country that are 50-50, we will elect candidates that have to attend first to their community and only second to their party. We wouldn't need term limits, and you would see an end to gridlock because we would have a Congress that works together. My concern with the Supreme Court ruling, in the name of fair districts, is they took what is one of the fairest districts in the country, everybody has a voice, Democrats and Republicans, and created likely a super Democrat district that will only contribute to the current dysfunction in Washington.
I know the law says lawmakers have to draw these districts. I think Texas somehow got around that by they appointed an independent commission.
Sure.
Would you be in favor of something like that?
I'm in favor of anything that gets us to 50-50 districts. I am. So I think states get to decide. Listen, the Supreme Court has ruled that states have a fair amount of leeway. Arizona was a recent decision allowing for independent commissions. Okay. I'm not opposed to it today. I would always prefer, I will tell you this, you know, a lot of times we look to set up independent commissions on anything or independent agencies or artificial term limits. I would always prefer we first examine, is there a way to make our elected officials most accountable, right? Because at the end of the day, we should have elected officials that are the closest to the polls. Every time we move in the direction of something that's independent, it just then subscribes to the influence of who appoints them. And that can become even more prejudicial than a system where our elected officials do it. We need to demand accountability from our elected officials. I would prefer that. Am I opposed to some type of alternative commission? Not necessarily, but it would depend on the level of accountability of those who serve on the commission.
Congressman David Jolly, candidate for U.S. Senate, thank you so much for joining us on Florida Matters.
Thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
And that is it for today's show, but the conversation continues online. We've extended invitations to the other candidates for Senate, and our political coverage continues throughout the year and, of course, into next year at WSFnews.org. And be sure to stop by our Facebook page for questions or comments, and maybe Congressman Jolly will stop by and answer a few of those questions on the Facebook.
Maybe we could do that. I'd enjoy that.
Florida Matters is produced by Lottie Watts. Our engineer is Craig George, and our program is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.